Okay. All right. So to kick things off, Chris, can you cue up that John Kerry clip? I just want to get in the right mindset. I need to see this again.
I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
Yeah, all right, boy, he's back.
Chris, you should edit this in, you know, just as a warning. Like, if you're a woman, fair warning, at the beginning of the show, we played some audio that will cause your ovaries to explode.
He is a five-star pimp, is all there is to it.
Yeah, John Kerry rocks.
He's dripping.
So he is cool. Welcome. Welcome to our new climate czar, John Kerry, and welcome to our guest for this week, Osita Nuevo of the New Republic. Osita, what's going on?
Not much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we figured you just had a piece coming out now in the New Republic about just the looking back on the Obama years, and now that we're, you know, in the era of Obama restoration, and Joe Biden is doing the Obama administration speed run. Hopefully, he can get through all 8 years and everyone who served in that government in the next four. So, but
so that we can get President MyPillow guy.
I want to talk to you about some of this stuff in Obama's memoir, some of the stuff about, you know, just sort of how it, I don't know. I'd be interested to see hear how much you think it's still Obama's party, or about what we could like expect for the next 4 years. But before we get there, I just do want to check in on the status of Team Trump and the legal action to stop the steal going on. I don't know if you've been following this. Sidney Powell, no longer part of Team Trump. She is no longer representing the Trump campaign. I believe she's representing various private lawsuits, which are amassing a huge trove of information about the stolen election. And she's not telling the information to judges because, like, every lawyer knows you don't present evidence to a judge.
No, obviously.
No, yeah, no.
Dumbass.
You don't, judges, yeah, no.
You tell the judge what you're going to do, so that they can either reject your case or hear it out. But like the idea is to just buy enough time to get all the documents so that the Supreme Court hears you. That's when the you unlock the fucking document case.
When you go in front of a judge, anyone other than the Supreme Court in any case, all you're really doing is going, don't believe me, just watch.
Yeah. If you show evidence to a judge, they put it under their robe and no one gets to see it again. So you better hold on to it. Yeah, you better be sure you'll win.
That's what's
going on here.
It should be noted that like basically 3 days ago, the GOP's official Twitter account was like, meet Sidney Powell. She's on our team. She's got the goods. She's going to release the Kraken. And then 3 days later, they're like, Sidney Powell is no longer affiliated with the Trump legal team.
The Kraken died.
Yeah, the Kraken died, and I think it probably has something to do with her argument in court that the Republican governor and Secretary of State of Georgia literally colluded with Hugo Chavez to steal the election for money. So I think that might be why they're ditching her, but I don't know. Osita, have you been following the Trump legal, the Trump campaign 2.0, the legal campaign?
I've been trying to, man, and it's been hard. We're in a place now where the argument on the right now is that Brian Kemp is too into democracy. Like, that's where things have gone in the last 2 years. I watched a little bit of that press conference from a couple of days ago where there was some, like, oil or liquid exuding from Rudy Giuliani's skull or something.
It was like the X-Files. It was the black oil from that. Like, the alien host, it was leaving him. It was leaving his body.
That was excess testosterone.
Of course. But, like, you know, I think at that conference they were trying to invoke Hugo Chavez and suggesting that there was, like, a huge plot connected with Venezuela in some way to steal the votes. And in that kind of environment, I don't know how you fire somebody for being too unserious. Like, I don't know what the actual grounds.
We know for a fact that Trump gets very mad at his underlings when he sees them on TV and he doesn't think that they looked good.
Yeah.
I watched the Rudy Giuliani press conference, the second half of it anyway. And by the way, like I started watching it after I saw the memes about his face dripping, his face coming off of him, and I just thought, oh shit. I turned it on and he wasn't talking anymore. And I just assumed, well, he'll have dobbed them off by now. He's not talking anymore. Oh, no. They kept going. He didn't notice it until like right at the end. And I saw her talk, and she sounded like a crazy person.
Yeah, no, she. It's not just that the content of what she said was
crazy. Exactly. It's not, I'm not talking about her saying, like, they went to Venezuela and got Hugo Chavez, like, whatever, the words don't. We're not talking about words. Like, people watch this like dogs do. It's about tone.
Yeah.
She sounded like a crazy person. She sounded like somebody in front of a bus station with newspapers in her boots.
Yeah.
Had the votes for President Trump not been so overwhelming in so many of these states that it broke the algorithm that had been plugged into the system, that's when they came in the back door with all the mail-in ballots, many of which they had actually fabricated with identically matching perfect circle dots for Mr. Biden.
It was also like the aesthetic choices of the press conferences were interesting. Like, obviously, there's Rudy and his, like, the soy sauce he put in his hair falling down his face. But, like, Sydney Pollack's like, I'm
Sydney Pollack. Sydney Pollack.
Yeah. Her, the deceased director.
She was like, Brian Kemp fucked his brains out. You know, it's life. Life goes on. And then it doesn't, right?
Yeah. Her outfit was like a leopard print cardigan.
Yeah,
that was her fancy lawyer outfit. Like, it was a bad look. And I think Trump's going to keep Giuliani around forever because it's like, you know, we talked about how Giuliani is the court jester for America now. And I think Trump likes having like a slapstick guy like that around. But Sidney Powell just, she's not going to get anything done.
Oh, God, no.
No, yeah, she's actually very ill.
So Sidney Powell, I mean, did you guys see the thing where Tucker Carlson is now being accused of being a member of the Pizzagate child pedophilia conspiracy?
Yeah.
He had Sidney Powell on his show and just simply asked her, what is the evidence for this massive election fraud? And she was just like, Matt said, don't believe me, just watch. And just for asking that question, Tucker Carlson is now on the enemies list. And I guess, like,
it's so perfect how that works too, because the QAnon like excommunication process with any celebrity or politician works the same, because if you turn your baleful Q eye onto someone and look at them through the Q lens, and they're rich and a connected person in this country, you will find the same connections to pedophile sickos that every other fucking rich person that you think is a pedophile has. And so you'll be like, aha, because it was always there. You just weren't looking because you thought he was on your side.
Well, I mean, I think that Carlson has been trying to walk this very delicate line from the beginning of this thing. My take on this whole charade for really months has been that if Trump actually lost, we were definitely going to see all that we're seeing from him directly, this idea that the election is being stolen, there's a lot of fraud. But my take has been that the Republican Party is not invested enough in Trump being president again to materially help him in any kind of way.
Yeah.
Conservative media infrastructure as well. So they'll definitely, you know, say, oh, we should, you know, take these legal cases seriously and their shenanigans are afoot and whatever. But they were never going to actually, at least a critical mass of them and the most important people, were never going to actually do what would have taken to let Trump avail here. So Carlson has been one of the people who's been put out in front with the task of talking people down.
Right.
Yes, we know that you're mad. We got to look into this, but you know, maybe he actually lost, right?
He's essentially trying to soothe the temper tantrum.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. There's been an interesting, I guess everyone speaks the same language now of trauma and giving people time to heal. And Tucker Carlson, Tucker Carlson is like, he's sort of the tough love therapist for the MAGA people, where it's like, I know, it was very unfair. Take your time to heal. But yeah, no, I mean, QAnon, I mean, first of all, I think QAnon is an actual deep state project. Like, if you were going to invent a conspiracy theory that was meant to discredit other more credible conspiracy theories, I think it would look a lot like QAnon and Pizzagate. But it's also, it takes two to tango. And the reason people are into QAnon is because it's sort of like the last spasm of everyone knows this is ending. Whatever this is, we know it's ending. And one response is that you drown yourself in GIFs and, you know, like the president hanging out with Jonathan Van Ness or fucking whatever. And you don't have anything to back it up, but a new day is coming. It's morning in America. Or you believe in this sort of fortress America coming back and a sort of merger of Bircherism and Reagan will rule forever. And QAnon is just, it's like in that type of brain that wants that, it's the DMT vision before you die.
Yeah.
And it's not like, there's nothing you can really do to get anyone out of it. You can't fact check your way out of it.
It's the world where JFK didn't die.
Yeah. There's nothing you can do to fact check out of it or like deplatform out of it. It's just like, that's what happens when this comes to an end. That like 30% of the country just believes in magic now.
Yeah.
That's what happens. Sorry, you can't do anything about it. That's one of the reasons why it's bad to have an empire. Yeah. Sorry.
And on the other side, you have a Democratic base that is to almost completely in some degree of delusional denial about their relationship to the Democratic Party that is as psychically twisted as any kind of Q cosmology.
Yeah.
Like the way that the average Democrat views the party that they vote for is as delusional in its relationship to reality as a fantasy about underground pizza, child-eating dungeon.
Matt, you're sure you're not experiencing democracy foreplay right now? Is that what you're trying
to... I'm not edging towards democracy. Although I give that lady credit, the lady who said that she's can't wait to have the democracy orgasm on Inauguration Day, at least she's imagining that this, like, libidinal dance that she's doing with politics as a spectacle and part of her life is going to actually end in an orgasm. What the hell are the rest of us getting out of it?
A back rub for Tony Blinken.
Well, I want to talk about let's go back in time now, because I mean, I know you guys have been seeing this part one of Obama's memoir is out, and I know you guys have been looking at a lot of the same excerpts that I've been looking at, and I think this would be like a good time to like discuss like just based on the excerpts I've seen in this book, and then Osita's piece about Obama and his years, like how Obama sees himself and like how the party sees itself as being a sort of like who's leading who here. And the first excerpt I want to talk about is this pretty incredible excerpt where he talks about the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. And I'm just quoting here. He says, Iraq's attempted 1980 invasion of Iran and the bloody eight-year war that followed, a war in which the Gulf states provided Saddam Hussein with financing while the Soviets supplied Khomeini's military with arms, including chemical weapons, accelerated Iran's sponsorship of terrorism as a way to offset its enemy's military advantages. Okay. The Soviet Union not only did not supply Khomeini with chemical weapons, it actually provided weapons to Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war. And it was America who supplied Iraq with the chemical weapons that were used on Iran. Osita, do you think Obama just isn't aware of this? Or like, you think this is just an error in his knowledge? Or is this like a conscious like lie on his part? Or is it impossible to say?
I think it's difficult to say. I mean, I think one thing that we are being reminded of, not just with Obama, but with Biden in the last few weeks, is that these are people who just get most of their worldview from people like Tom Friedman, New York Times op-ed page, Fareed Zakaria, that entire nexus of commentators who are shaping the way elites think about American foreign policy. I think that Obama and Biden are people who genuinely trust those voices and have genuinely sort of derived a worldview from the things they hear. From that cohort. I mean, people have said
they think there's something called a national interest and it's served by these people.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know whether it's an actual lie or something else, but I do think that there is a level of uncritical acceptance of particular narratives about American foreign policy on Obama's part and Biden's part as well. I think that they genuinely trust the stories that they've been told.
And, you know, one of those stories would be the Iran-Iraq war was bad because both sides were, you know, selling arms to every side, and that, like, you know, America's role in that and who we were selling arms to is just sort of elided. And there's a line you have in your piece in the New Republic about Obama that I thought was really, really interesting and on point, where, like, you talked about how Obama, like, he has this genius way of talking about politics where he presents himself as sort of demystifying like the processes and nature of our political system, but is actually doing the complete opposite. Like he mystifies through this pretend demystification. And I was wondering if you could like explain a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, so I wrote that in reference to a speech that Biden made last week where he talked about deciding to cooperate, that our problems in Washington are a consequence of Democrats and Republicans simply not making the right choice, and the right choice being we're going to set aside our differences and come together and whatever. And this was sort of him being or trying to be the adult in the room and suggesting that there's a level of personal, like our problems in politics are a matter of personal temperament, right? And not making the choice to collaborate with people on the other side. That to me reminded me a lot of the speech that put Obama on the national stage in 2004, his Democratic National Convention speech, where he talks about, well, we're not actually the blue states, the red states, we're the United States. And it's framed as like, oh, this is like the answer. Like we've been fed this lie that there are actual real divisions in American life. But really, if you get past all that, the hard truth that you will come to understand if you're a smart person is that we should all hold hands and make things work for the country or something. Like it's this weird way of presenting a message as a kind of, I don't know, a secret key to unlock everything, right? And the thing that is clarifying that actually just ends up puzzling people or sort of stupefying people even more because it's an even more radically unreal version of what is happening than the thing that you're trying to dismystify in the first place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I mean, and another thing you point out is that in his own writing, Obama makes it clear that he's not unaware of like the critiques from his left or whatever being essentially, if all things are being equal, correct, at least vis-a-vis like, you know, healthcare reform or things like that. And there's another example where he's quoted talking of Biden's recent comments that like, you know, I know how to deal with Mitch McConnell because we've been friends for years. And Obama was like, well, yeah, Joe knows Mitch McConnell. They've known each other for a long time, but they're not friends. So he's like, I mean, you think is he trying to give Biden some fucking advice before he takes office?
I don't think so. So I read that in other portions of the excerpts where he's being candid about certain realities. I honestly read that as him trying to save face for posterity. Like, I think he cares a lot about his own legacy and he's aware enough of where things are going just sort of as a historical trend line to know that 20, 30, 40 years from now, people are going to look back at his presidency and his way of thinking about politics and they'll understand that it was nonsense, that it was bullshit. And so he has to signal now that he's aware of that so that history's judgment on him isn't as harsh as it would otherwise be. So he has to include things in his memoirs and in his writings and in his speeches where he acknowledges reality now. I don't think it's him signaling to Biden as much as it is him sort of trying to give himself like an insurance policy for his own public reception down the line.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, the key to understanding Obama, I feel like, has always been he cares about his legacy in how it will appear on in, you know, retrospectives and movies and everything like that in the cultural memory years from now. He doesn't – people – whenever people talked about Obama fretting about his legacy after Trump, people on the left would go, oh, that's bullshit. He doesn't care. He doesn't care about anything. And it's like, no, he does care about his legacy, but in this very – in a way that's only focused on media consumption.
Yeah, his entire existence is to be talked about in the media the same way it is with Trump, only he wants it to be approvingly.
Yeah.
He has the same detachment, as we said, from like actually governing that Trump does. Like he's totally Trump. Obama just glided through the presidency because he always just assumed he wasn't actually in charge of anything. But he was learning something. He was having the promised land delivered to him, and it was going to be then reflected in an audience like affirming that. And so as soon as he gets out of office, all he cares about is his legacy and becoming a goddamn fucking Netflix producer and content guru, because that's literally the end goal of like everybody in the educated classes in America now. It is to mythologize yourself for others, even though you never fucking did anything.
Yeah, Obama, I mean, the way he looked at the presidency itself, actually very similar to being a reality TV star.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things you point out in the piece, Osita, is that like Obama said, like in an interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, he was like, you know, who's your ideal reader for this book? And Obama said it was like a 25-year-old who was like interested in politics and like wanted to do good in the world or contribute in some way. And I think you pointed out, like, for anyone who's 25 now and interested in politics, like Obama's presidency was the example that like turned them into like psychopaths or listeners to podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I don't know where he's finding this. I mean, I'm sure that there are people who are still you know, who are going to go into the Biden administration really excited to have a Democratic revival, who are really young and hoping that they're going to get some position somewhere on a campaign that means something. And like, I think that cadre of people still exists. It's just much smaller now. And so the 25-year-olds who Obama is mostly contending with are people who have been radicalized by the failures of the last 10 years. And again, I think he knows that. So like, his appeal to that portion of the public and his appeal to posterity is creating the space in the memoir where he actually says, well, yeah, it was kind of true that like the pharmaceutical industry like owned the Democratic Party. And yeah, that was why we didn't do a public option, right? Like it's him acknowledging, again, reality, because he knows that the narrative is kind of collapsed and he has to create a space for himself where he's still going to find respect in the future. And that means acknowledging certain things, not because he hopes that Biden actually learns from any of it, but as a sort of self-preservation of his own legacy.
I mean, as long as you're talking about preserving his legacy, but I mean, cutting against that, at least that 25-year-old in terms of things that absolutely nobody wants to hear. There was another excerpt about it where he talked about his inauguration and the protests that greeted George W. Bush as he left office. And he writes here, quote, "I felt quietly angry on his behalf. To protest a man in the final hour of his presidency seemed graceless and unnecessary. More generally, I was troubled by what these last-minute protests said about the divisions that were churning across the country and the weakening of whatever boundaries of decorum had once regulated politics." I mean, he's talking about a guy that killed 1 million people in Iraq, and he's just like, it was graceless of people to fucking boo him on the way out the door. I mean, who is this for? Because that's not for the 25-year-old young Democratic progressive activist or whatever. I mean, this
has to be all people. All he has to be a man for all people, right? Like that's again, he in a way that like. And we were just talking about Tucker Carlson being sort of the guy who has to manage the Republicans as like a constituency now. I think that everybody who is a major public figure, really always, but especially today, has to sort of ride these like intrinsic divisions within their respective constituencies. So Obama wants to be liked by the 25-year-old. He wants to be liked by the Washington establishment. He wants to be liked by sort of generic Democrat suburban voters. And the memoir is supposed to appeal to as many of those people as possible, even if there are sort of contradictory messages and contradictory ideas within them. The hope is that all of that will be sort of brushed aside, subsumed by Obama as like an icon and somebody who like is this transcendent figure at the end of the day, no matter what you think about him. But yeah, like the Bush thing, if you read it on its own, is not going to appeal to, I don't know, like I think that even generic Democrats at this point, I mean, I guess there's been this revival of Bush's legacy and there are people who enter into that, but you know, the idea that protesting a public figure is somehow indecorous now, I think is kind of an idea that's gone by the wayside. I don't know that anybody really thinks that way about politics anymore, really. Even people who are disapproving of like yelling at Trump officials who are eating in restaurants like they were in 2018, like even that's kind of half-hearted and isn't really as full of an ethos as civility was in the Obama era.
Yeah, like the idea that it's indecorous or something, or for like average citizens to voice their anger publicly at a president. It's like, you know, hey, I punch up, not down.
Yeah.
Speaking of, don't boo vote.
That's what he said. Don't boo vote.
Here's another excerpt. This one actually struck me as like the most jaw dropping and telling in the book, and it's where he's talking about his old friend Reverend Wright. And I got to say, during the 2008 campaign, like that was like the fucking, that was the starting gun that should have let everyone know that this guy was full of shit, is like how easily he fucking threw Reverend Wright, his own fucking minister, under the bus for like, you know, he just says here, there were times when I found Reverend Wright's sermons a little over the top. In the middle of a scholarly explication of the Book of Matthew or Luke, he might insert a scathing critique of America's drug war, America's militarism, capitalist greed, or the intractability of American racism. Rants that were usually grounded in fact, but bereft of context. Often they sounded dated, as if you were channeling a college teach-in from 1968, rather than leading a prosperous congregation that included police commanders, celebrities, wealthy business people, and the Chicago school superintendent. So, I mean, what's he saying here? Like, Reverend Wright saying things that are correct factually, but are wrong in the context of saying them to people who are well off and like somewhat celebrated?
I mean, my thought about Reverend Wright for a while now has been that Obama's relationship with him actually mattered, people sort of tried to dismiss it in 2008 as like, oh, this is like a smear and it's trying to do racial demagoguery. And it was that, but like it did substantively matter. It mattered substantively in the opposite way that the conservatives intended. It was not a signal that Obama was like a secret radical or whatever. It was a signal that Obama was somebody who was definitely exposed to radical thought and consciously rejected it. And that matters a lot. And, it, and you know, this is like the thing that's important about, people have laughed about, you know, the long legged socialist passage and like trying to get people to date him in college with Foucault or whatever. And it's funny, but like it also like, again, should concretize our sense of Obama as somebody who is not unaware that you can make radical, more radical critiques of the way things are. He's somebody who has been exposed to all of that. And for whatever reason has consciously decided that he wanted to go a different way in his politics. And that's what Reverend Wright means to me. I mean, he's somebody who I think Obama sort of glommed onto because it was important to be connect with the black church to make it in politics in Chicago, right? And after he performed that function, he was no longer useful. So as long as he was performing that function, he was willing to sit there and listen to talk about the drug war and American foreign policy and all these kinds of things while not really taking in any of it and really taking any of it seriously, even though I think there are a lot of people in this, or most people in that congregation probably did take it very seriously and were willing to harbor more radical critiques of the way things were. So I don't know. I think that Wright is, again, I think another window into who Obama actually is and the way he thinks about things you know, I don't think you can credit, I don't think you can blame Obama's politics or his presidency on a sort of naivete about capitalism or whatever else. Like he understands the critiques and is decided to reject them.
Yeah, Obama is, I mean, he's been an operator his entire professional life. He always has been. I mean, Reverend Wright was not an unknown quantity in Chicago.
Yeah.
And especially not in Chicago political circles. People knew what he was about. He was, I mean, Reverend Wright's all is a very interesting and kind of benevolent figure, because another guy from Chicago who people try to tar the left and Democrats with, Farrakhan, Farrakhan exists because there aren't enough Reverend Wrights. That is to say, he's this specter of like non-liberal or non-democratic or non-Christian black politics that only exists because everything else in that space has been, you know, literally assassinated by the government or marginalized or just like put out of existence. And Reverend Wright is like one of the only options that people had, one of the only good options that people had. Obama knew what he was getting into, but when he needed to be seen going to that church, he was seen doing it. And I actually think the Wright controversy when he became a national figure, I think that actually helped him with what he sought to accomplish, which was getting the cosign from the Democratic establishment and like David Geffen.
Sister soldier.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
He wanted to show those people that he would shiv this fucking guy. This guy who kind of did a lot for him. He wanted to show them, you think the Clintons are ruthless? Look at what I'll do. You haven't even given me anything up front yet, really. Look what I'll do for you.
Yeah, I'm not going to flinch when you hand me the adrenochrome at the ceremony. I'm fine. I know what I know what's going to happen.
Obama is, I mean, I think he may be a more cynical person than Hillary Clinton. Because Hillary Clinton, I think she kind of believes in this bullshit. Like, whatever, like, weird meritocratic liberalism and, like, you know, the best test scores rise up and help cement the power, institute democracy all over the world. I think she legitimately believes that. I think she legitimately believes in the people around her and the importance of Clinton world. And I think the fact that so many people went down with her ship and she down with theirs shows that. Obama sort of only believes in his historical projection. He's someone who's been living almost his entire life at this point in the third person.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it. Is that he is detached completely from politics, because I think that the difference between him and Hillary Clinton is, I think Hillary is, at the end of the day, she's a Whig. She believes in human progress and that she is helping it occur. Whereas Obama, I think, is he's too conceited about himself to allow himself to believe something so naive. So he accepts he probably accepts like the basic truth of like a lot of radical critiques of capitalism, but he says, but the crooked timber of humanity cannot be made straight. The Niebuhrian like tragic notion that we are doomed by our own human, you know, deficiencies to this veil of tears, and in this world we can only do so much. And then therefore everything he does, his entire career of just taking all popular discontent with this buckling and wheezing monstrous exploitation system and smoothing it over and doing whatever it took behind the scenes to recapitalize the economy on the backs of regular people, and then getting a gloss on it and making it look progressive and making it look like to millions of Americans, making it look like progress and making it look like oppression to millions other, and never feel like he had anything to do with it because it was going to happen anyway. And wouldn't it be better for someone like him to be in that room than someone else who didn't have his exquisite soul and ability to like to grow and be enriched by these experiences?
Yeah, people. I always think back to the early Obama days when people would imagine, if they were conservatives, imagine Obama as Big Brother or Hitler in some cases. The most horrifying character from our cultural imagination that Obama most reminds me of is Patrick Bateman.
Hmm.
Just a fucking empty vessel who knows exactly what buttons of affect to push for whatever group of people he's around, who is aware of his own emptiness.
You know what he is? He's a fucking prestige TV anti-hero.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, it's sort of a Don Draper.
Donald Trump is a literal reality TV cretin, and Obama is a figurative, and it has to be figurative because these are the smart people. This is the smart party. This is like the smart political tendency. He is an allegory for a prestige TV anti-hero.
And Hillary is like Sons of Anarchy. She's like, yes. No, fuck you. I'm loyal to the Anthony Weiner. I don't care what you did, Anthony.
Because they're from the 90s. The Clintons are from the 90s. Yeah. They weren't there to like get in hip with like, you know, because with the new shit after the Sopranos model, they're just like blundering around Kurt Sutter style.
Yeah.
Well, as long as you're talking about the Sopranos, Sita, you do make reference to Obama's recent comments about historical conceptions of American masculinity as personified by Clint Eastwood, John Wayne, and Gary Cooper, which does, I mean, I think we've clocked this before on the show, does mirror precisely Tony's comments to Dr. Melfi about, you know, what happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? Now everyone's bitching to Sally, Jesse, Raphael. And I also like that you point out that all four of those men that are held up as like the kind of template for traditional American masculinity and like these values that Trump supposedly espouses were all dyed-in-the-wool reactionaries for their entire careers.
Oh, yeah.
Eastwood included. I mean, Eastwood's the only one that's still around, but I mean, he's probably the most, I mean, but like the idea that Clint Eastwood was like more right wing than Jimmy Stewart or fucking Gary Cooper is bullshit. Like, if anything, he's probably like less reactionary than those guys. Certainly
same
John Wayne.
Same with Trump, probably. Yeah. Honestly speaking. You know, when I read that quote, the first thing that came to mind was that the pilot episode of The Sopranos where, you know, Tony was talking about what were fictional representations. This is the crazy thing. Like these are people who've played fake people and presented an image that was directly at odds with the society that they were actually entertaining, right? There was a much more cruel and violent society than our society today in a lot of ways. But because the images that we have carried over from that era and the people like Obama and people like Tony Soprano fictionally inherited, you know, those people who are too young, I guess, to have lived in the 30s and the 40s, like, I guess, accept as real those images on some level and believe that people actually lived up to them. And Trump, you then come to understand, is an aberration because he's deviated from this model of masculinity. But, you know, I think part of what The Sopranos is doing is telling you that, look, like, you can sort of hearken back to and idealize this model of masculinity, of reserve and quiet and whatever, and also be like an emotional wreck and extremely vulnerable and extremely like violent yourself and kill people, and it doesn't really
wind up in therapy. You know,
and wind up in therapy. Yeah. Exactly. So whatever story you tell yourself, and however much you think you're measuring up to a Gary Cooper, like those images were not real, and they were, you know, they were if they were idealized, they were idealized because they were at a remove and at a place of real distance from what people were actually doing, and probably what human beings are actually capable of. So I don't know. I thought it was very odd that he invoked those people, not just because of the, you know, their own politics, but, you know, the mood in the Democratic Party and on the progressive, you know, identity politics left is always, or has recently been, you know, we should abandon that way of thinking about the world and these kinds of heroes and understand them as fake. James Baldwin, when he debated William F. Buckley in 1965, had this great line where he said, you know, I spent my youth rooting for Gary Cooper against the Indians, only to realize at a certain point that the Indians were me, right?
Yeah.
And Obama apparently doesn't have like that kind of an understanding of what these figures were and what they meant to people.
And then Buckley said, if you call me Chief Sitting Bull again, I'll knock you in the jaw, queer.
I always loved the Gary Cooper line in The Sopranos. And because it's like it's a multi-layered joke, it's like on its face, it's ridiculous because it's like, why isn't anyone like an actor from like 60 years ago? Like, who give, like, what are you talking about? But the joke of that, it goes deeper. It's that Tony is actually like the most self-pitying crybaby. Like, everything is done for Tony's personal validation. There's no difference between Tony at his core and like someone who writes mediums, first person essay mediums about, you know, how hard it is to have like a fucking philosophy PhD or whatever. What's interesting, Obama reflecting that line, is that is actually something I don't think about Obama at all, that he feels sorry for himself. I think Obama is in awe of himself, but I think Trump is most similar to the guy saying the Gary Cooper line. Trump's entire thing is that sort of Tony Soprano model of projecting this type of masculinity, kind of, but really just feeling bad about yourself and wanting your own personal validation. But Obama is an interesting figure to me in that way, in that I think someone posted Nixon's concession speech from 1960 today, and it was, they noted that for its time, it was considered an incredibly fucking just embarrassingly emotional display, that no politician should behave that way. And now that's really, if he did that today, he would be praised for being emotionally subdued compared to everyone. Everyone just goes about in public feeling bad for themselves, whether they command armies or they're the head of the treasury or whatever. Everything is about how bad can you get people to feel for you.
And Felix, and all the time a great wind is carrying them.
All the time, yeah. We go about self-pity, but yeah. Obama, if I could pick one thing besides his obvious charisma and like his sort of ease at which he speaks, at which he's around people, I think it's the fact why people are still so into him. I think it's the fact that he doesn't appear sorry for himself in the way that literally everyone else
does. He's a winner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obama, like the difference between Obama and any other like off brand version of him is that he did it. You know?
Yeah.
And he's able to just coast on that.
That's what I want to
for a long ass time.
Yeah, like, Beto, just like Beto tried the Obama thing, but Beto's a fucking
He's a loser.
He's a fucking loser. That's who he is. He's being a loser to him is as genetically part of his identity as like being Irish.
Yep. And those two, you find a lot of them, a lot of things. Never mind. Okay. I shouldn't have said that.
Well, I mean, I guess that's the last question I want to go with OCD here. Because I mean, at the end of the day, Obama, unlike, you know, many of his clones or like many other figures in the Democratic Party, is a winner. And it's like, it's not the Clinton's party anymore because like Hillary fucking lost. And Obama is like the closest thing the Democrats have, like as a figure at that level, as a guy who won. And he won pretty handily both times. So like it's, you know, his template for how to run an election, how to run a campaign how to manage the sort of Democratic Party and its various constituencies and how to tamp down their expectations and sort of coast by on personality, but also as a template for how to, negotiate in scare quotes here with the Republican Party. And I guess what I'm asking Asita is, if we're looking at the Biden administration as just like a speed run of Obama part two, I mean, do you see this going forward? How do you see Biden sort of borrowing from the Obama model of how to be president?
Well, I think that all of the sort of we're going to try to work with Republicans and who to the center and not seem so crazy. All of that is going to stay in place. I will say, though, that Obama, Joe Biden is not a winner. And we know that in part because Obama himself seems to lack faith in Joe Biden. I mean, there's this stuff when he was thinking about coming in where people were saying, well, Obama has said he doesn't really want Biden to come in and embarrass himself and so on. Like, there's not a lot of faith, I think, within a Democratic
Party.
Anyone
can fuck it up. It's Joe Biden.
So, you know, he's not a winner. I don't think that Biden is somebody whose politics you can even kind of superficially recognize. Like, he's of a generation that is going away. Maybe we see in 2022 a bunch of, like, random 70-somethings running in primaries on the Biden avuncular sort of model. I don't really think it can be done. So it's this weird stopping point, I think, for the Democratic Party's trajectory. I think the people that the party really wanted to carry things forward were people like Kamala Harris, people like Pete Buttigieg, etc.
But then dog won't hunt.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a weird time to be an aspiring Democratic politico because you've had this interloper come in and seize this thing. But, you know, I think you're right that the Democratic Party does every generation try to find the figure that they're going to sort of put in front of themselves as the model they should be trying to emulate. That's what happened with Clinton. It's what happened with Obama. And the ground is kind of open now because there's been this interruption of the process when somebody of a previous generation coming in and interrupting and sort of blocking people off. And this is what you're seeing in the House, by the way, people are complaining about the fact that people like Pelosi and Clyburn and Hoyer are sticking in there and they're not letting the younger moderates come in and present themselves as the new leaders of the party. There's this across-the-board kind of gerontocracy that is, I think, toppling or stopping careers and from the moderates' perspective, cramping their style. And, you know, I think the story of the next 4 to 8 years is going to be the story of how the moderates come in and try to disrupt that and put new people forward. If you're on the left, I don't think any of it's really of much interest to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's all internal house bullshit.
Yeah, so...
castle intrigues.
Unless you have a fantasy teams for this shit, which I really sincerely hope you do not.
Excuse me, my thehill.com fantasy league is doing quite well.
Very grim.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there with you, Asita. I want to thank you for hanging out with us for a bit. If people would like to find more of your writing or takes, where should they go?
You should go to the New Republic, just newrepublic.com, or my Twitter account, Asita Wenevu, no spaces. I imagine if you're listening to this show, you probably have already seen one of those two things, at least, already.
All right, well, we'll go check it out. We're going to take a quick break, and then Matt Felix and I will be back to vibe with you further. Asita, thanks a lot.
Awesome, thanks.
Thank you, Asita.
Cheers.
Yeah, thanks.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do. See, what they didn't know was once they got Gary Cooper in touch with his feelings, that they wouldn't be able to shut him up. And then it's dysfunction this, and dysfunction that, and dysfunction my fungal.
You have strong feelings about this.
Let me tell you something. I had a semester and a half of college, so I understand Freud. I understand therapy as a concept. But in my world, it does not go down. Could I be happier? Yeah. Yeah. Who couldn't?
Do you feel depressed? Do you feel depressed?
Since the ducks left.
All right. Part two of the show. Let's just vibe. You want to just like kick it off with that Tony Blinken?
Yes. Let's rock it to the right, free world. Yeah, with Tony Blinken.
Listen, Tony Blinken Park. Tony Blinken 182.
Nice.
There we go. Let's keep it going. All right. So this is Joe Biden's soon to be Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, who's like, you know, sort of like secretary of state of relaxation and coolness. This seems like pretty chill yacht rock. This is Lip Service by A. Blinken. Little play.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's copying Elvis Costello's song title, so I don't know how I feel about that. Right. Lip Service by A. Blinken.
He looks very handsome. When was the last time we had a studly Secretary of State?
Mike Pompeo.
Oh, God. Ball of suet. No, thank you. God.
He's right there, Matt.
The guy's like
right
if Ziggy was a real person. And then I came on to you.
But you said, let's just be friends.
Yeah. Oh my God. This is like South of the Crystal Cave.
It's better. It's a little better than that. He's got an interesting voice.
Yeah, it's kind of husky.
Yeah, it's like sort of like a de-swagged Roy Orbison. Gave Roy Orbison surgery to remove his swag.
I drove all night just to get to the Brookings Institute.
Who's that? What's that? I wanna
convince you. Lip Service tonight. This song's about getting top.
Okay, I figured out what this is like. I know it's a mistake
to open my heart. All right, there we go.
I figured out exactly what that's like. It used to be fun in the mid-2000s to like read Stormfront because they were like 60-year-old foul Nazis as opposed to like 19-year-old Nazis who have like a lifetime of that ahead of them. Yeah. And they were just mostly just like pathetic fucking losers, like guys who were like just claim adjusters for 40 years and were like, I'm going to repopulate the white race any day now. And they're like 50. It was just like losers, like people who try to get their kids into Nazism and fail and like their family wouldn't talk to them. But the funniest threads to read on Stormfront were the ones that are like, I have a question. Can you be into white pride and still enjoy Moana? Like people are afraid of enjoying like non-white entertainment. And this is like if someone on Stormfront was like, I enjoy Chris Isaac, but he sounds a little bit too black for me. So I made my own Chris Isaac with a more white sound. That's exactly what this is like.
Apparently, Tony Blinken is like, he's a Steely Dan guy. You know, he's into yep. Steely Dan, which is like, that's a very specific type.
That is a white flag.
That is a very specific type of dude.
Anybody who likes Steely Dan has to at least get one jot into the old warning list. You got to watch that.
And Matt, what was it you're saying? Like he's in another band with a guy who used to be like in the Doobie Brothers, who then became an arms control expert.
This guy's name, the guy's Skunk Brewster, I think his name is. He was in the Doobie Brothers, I think, and he, after that, became an expert on missile defense and ended up becoming a consultant for the Defense Department on Star Wars and shit. And he rocks out with Tony Blinken here in the group that they jokingly refer to as Coalition of the Willing.
Wow.
Everyone's having fun. Everyone in Washington, D.C. always having fun.
And just to think
we love to see them have fun, don't we, folks?
And just to think that band Viet Cong had to change their fucking name because people complained about it. And these assholes, Coalition of the Willing. Hey, check out their new latest EP. You Forgot Poland. We Forgot Poland. The new EP from Coalition of the Willing. Yeah. Poland.
I guess it would be cuter if Joe Biden didn't whip up support for the Iraq War amongst Democrats.
Yeah.
But hey, who am I to say? What do these people always say about Trump? The cruelty is the point.
Yeah. No, in this time, no. See, that's the thing, is that when Republicans do it, the cruelty is the point. When Democrats do it, the cruelty is an unfortunate side effect.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate
side effect.
That's the only difference.
It's just two sides of the same coin, and it's how you feel about it. It's who you blame for it. It's who you're rooting for in the little Punch Judy show. But at the end of the day, the cruelty is there.
Just like how there's no real difference in Tony Blinken having a consulting firm that helps companies navigate Pentagon consulting projects contracts. Which, I mean, doesn't that sound like self-dealing a little bit?
Yeah.
Doesn't that sound like the exact same thing we got mad at Betsy DeVos and Mike Pompeo for?
Yeah.
But no, it's just, he didn't know he was doing anything wrong.
I know you guys saw that fucking twerp from Vox be like, Tony, it appears that Tony Blinken has participated in society. Like, he's like just like doing like the worst fucking internet meme ever about, you live in a society. But on behalf of a guy who fucking left public service to just cake up on the defense industry's fucking dime and fucking like,
Mike, this is a guy who bitched about Michael Flynn going to an RT dinner. Isn't that just living in society?
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Yeah, he's got to feed big idiot son. I mean, my God. You know how many times he's been fired for Bed Bath & Beyond? They cannot keep – he's got credit card debt. He buys commemorative chess sets. He's just sitting around gaming and, like, buying pay-per-view. We have broadband, and he still buys fucking pay-per-view. To feed my idiot child. I can't go to a fucking banquet sit next to Jill Stein and collect some rubles.
And that's the
thing. You try raising my son.
That's the thing. Tony Blinken and his problems, they're not individually important. And the most useless question that people have asked is, who would you guys be okay with? What Bernie guy would you be okay with? No one. No one that Joe Biden would ever pick. That's why I didn't vote for him. That's why I didn't support him. That's why I didn't give a shit about this entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because
There's
no one that Joe Biden would ever pick. And now that would ever get confirmed by the Senate that he's likely getting due to his own failures. And
even if it's somebody you maybe like in abstract, if he picked them, it would be because they would be frozen out of any actual influence.
Right, exactly. He would have final say. So that's it. It's not a useful question. Joe Biden's never going to pick a guy who's like, all right, day one, we're getting rid of NATO. That's never going to happen. You know, you might as well say, what are you going to do when Joe Biden gives you the ability to fly? Because it's just as useless as a fucking question. But my point is the same point that we've had since Trump. It's that all these assholes do the same fucking thing and that they are equally delusional. This delusion that Tony Blinken has and that Joe Biden has that we can rebuild the prestige of the American empire that we had in the 90s or even the 60s by, you know, having lunch with Netanyahu in the right way, it's equally deluded as anything else. This isn't coming back. The most realistic idea was to have someone that would negotiate our exit.
Yeah.
Now that's not happening.
Well,
now that's never fucking happening.
I would say, like, the actual difference between Tony Blinken and Mike Pompeo is that Tony Blinken is in favor of the Iran deal and was a big proponent of it and says that he may try, the Biden administration may try to, like, I don't know, re-enter the Iran deal. And, like, by the way, if you're Iran, why, what the fuck, like, reason would you have to, like, fucking trust America at all on any diplomatic level? Yeah, I would tell him to eat shit. And number two is that, unlike Mike Pompeo, Tony Blinken doesn't wholeheartedly believe that the rapture will happen in his lifetime. But I mean, aside from that, I mean, from what I've read about Tony Blinken's career as a sort of, you know, Democratic Party apparatchik and foreign policy guy, is that he was in favor of the Libya intervention. He was critical of the Obama administration for not using enough force in Syria, and still defends Joe Biden's vote for the Iraq war as, quote, a vote for tough diplomacy, not war.
That wasn't just him defending it. He was Biden's top foreign policy advisor when he voted to go to war. So he wasn't just saying he did the right thing by voting to invade Iraq. He was telling Joe Biden, vote to invade Iraq.
In the same token, we have Avril Haines coming up as DNI. Haines testified in favor of Gina Haspel, defending her role in CIA torturing. She had a role in redacting parts of the CIA torture report. One of her official jobs with the CIA was investigating the CIA to see if they had hacked into the computers of legislators who had questioned Michael Hayden. Who knows what she found, but if the CIA picked her to do it, what does that say about her?
Yeah.
You are getting the worst aspects of Obama term one foreign policy.
Because they're going to be like, we have to reassert America now because they all feel like Trump weakened our strategic position in all these spots. So they're going to have to, in their own minds, be aggressive on all areas because they have to shore back up our standing instead of, you know, allow, because we have actually, like, NATO has been undermined by Trump. One actual, like, long-term effect of his presidency. Accidental, oafish, idiotic, bull in a china shop idiocy, but a real effect. They want to reverse that. They want to reverse all the undermining that Trump did all over the world of American credibility, and that's going to mean carrots and sticks flailing around.
The other thing that I think you should look out for during this first Biden term, knowing what we know about his foreign policy team, it is going to be very late Roman Empire, and that is to say that Avril Haines is going to be running her own fiefdom.
A horse will be running their own fiefdom.
Yeah, well, that might be better than Avril Haines, but Blinken will be running his own fiefdom. John Kerry will be running his own thing. And they'll all be running their own thing because there's no one they can really report back to. You need a final say on a matter. You call the White House at 9 p.m. Oh, Joe's taking his nighttime milkshake. He's going to be asleep for 17 hours. So Haines, Haines wants to give a bunch of guns to these Azerbaijanis, okay? Blinken Blinken has Qatari clients with his consulting firm. They come to a head here. Who wins? Is it like when the Pentagon and the CIA's rebels would fight each other in Syria? Maybe a lot more of that. Get used to seeing that. Get used to seeing a lot of shakeups in the world.
Well, I mean, this is coming after, based Trump's foreign policy. He successfully, I think, neutralized people like Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, and Elliot Abrams after putting them in charge of his foreign policy. So, you know, kudos to the boy.
By the way, I meant to say Saudi Arabian clients, not Qatari.
Okay. I guess like the other cabinet pick that's worthy to talk about is fucking, of course, Rahm Emanuel, who I'm hearing today as a sop to angry progressive activists won't get Secretary of Transportation, but he'll just be put in charge of like negotiating trade deals with foreign countries. So something much less important than Transportation Secretary. But I mean, come on. The Democratic partisans out there who have been squawking for like, I don't know, 6 to 9 months now that it's everyone's moral duty to vote for the Democratic Party because that's what black women do are going to shut the fuck up real quickly. That Rahm Emanuel, like one of the worst fucking people on the planet, the guy who literally covered up a murder of a black teenager for the Chicago Police Department. Come right back inside, sir, right this way. And I guess just like, because black people still voted for Democrats overwhelmingly, like they co-signed that, you know, like, so that's good. And if you complain about that now or bring up the staggering hypocrisy of putting a guy like Rahm Emanuel back in charge, it's somehow on you, or it's like you're the one being racist or just colicky or something. It's just like, you know, get with the program. Kids in cages, we're off that. Black cruelty Lives Matter. Yeah, exactly.
Well, cruelty is the point. The point of Rahm Emanuel is like, this is looking down all the, you know, the more official, the more officially co-signed Black Lives Matter groups, the ones that were, you know, the ones that were branded to be co-opted by the DNC, not the larger movement at hand, the ones who asked for even just something from Joe Biden, like that pathetic open letter that one branch wrote after endorsing Biden, and to go, you're going to tell us what to do? Fuck you. Here's Rahm Emanuel. Fuck you.
You know what? It feels like
you know what the thing is? You can't do anything about it.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Like fucking post more about it, complain about it, lobby them, or just like, or just get angry at other people who point it out.
Yes.
Or who just say, this is it. Or just say, you're complaining about this now. You fucking bought this. This is what you promoted. Like, you did nothing but attack, like, anyone who fucking spoke out against this as being, like, if not actively helping Trump or on the other side, then just sort of foolishly undermining, hopeful progressive vision of the future with your these asks that you keep making of the Democratic Party. And it's just like, Felix, it reminds me when you say the cruelty is the point. It reminds me of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearing when I was like, they're obviously going to pull this guy. I mean, this is just insane, right? And it's like, no, they wanted to get him on the Supreme Court, even with that cloud of suspicion over him, because they wanted to prove to everyone that this shit doesn't matter. And they're like, if we want a guy credibly accused of rape on the Supreme Court in full view of everyone, we're going to do it because we can, and you can't stop us. What are you going to do? Vote against, like vote for the other guy? Complain more, write a letter to your editor. We don't give a shit. This is all sewn up. And like putting Rahm Emanuel right back in fucking the Democratic administration is the Democrats' version of that. Then they're saying to everyone like, complain more about it. What are you going to do? Vote Republican? Fuck you. You get nothing.
Exactly. It's to further beat people down. It's the same reason why they killed Jeffrey Epstein in front of us. What are you going to do about it, podcast?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah, yes.
We will. Yes, we will. We're going to keep doing that.
What else are we going to fucking do? We are going to podcast, and it's going to be dank, and it's going to be trill. There's going to be good japes and jokes. We're all going to have a good time.
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's a good place to wrap it up for today. I'd just like to wish everyone a preemptive happy Thanksgiving, no matter how you're spending it this year, whether you are all alone or you are going to create a super spreader event that will lead to an American Holocaust because, you just have to have those candied yams. Gotta eat those green beans. No, I'm just kidding. I really don't give a fuck what anyone does for Thanksgiving this year. Yeah, I really don't.
There's nothing stopping anything.
We're defeated as a nation. Like, really?
Yes, the white flag has been waved.
Yeah,
we've all surrendered at this point. Like, stop trying to negotiate for better terms. We've surrendered.
It's denial. People are working through their Kubler-Ross. It's like all the people who are, really. They're really hoping that like personal behavior is going to right this ship. They think that the mask tantrums are emotional and they are very childish. But at a certain level, you're failing to face reality in a similar way. I mean, that doesn't mean you just do whatever you want, but it means this thing of like making a part of your personality, yelling at everybody else, like making that your contribution to the common good. That's not doing anything. That's not doing anything except making you feel like you're a better person.
Well,
but
I would
do
like,
what you think is right, but do it.
Yeah,
that's
no.
That's not part of it.
I mean, no, I just sincerely, though, spending this holiday weekend, whether you're spending it by yourself, whether you're spending it in sheltering in place, or whether you're spending it with family, no matter what you're doing for this Thanksgiving, I just want to wish you a happy Thanksgiving and a happy holidays, and I hope you spend it with us, listening to your favorite podcast.
Here's a philosophical question for you that I'm going to leave you with. This will be taught in any 400-level philosophy class. If you are going to Thanksgiving solely to hold your uncle accountable for voting for Trump, does that invalidate that you're super spreading by traveling across the country?
I think it cancels it out. Yeah, it leaves you back to zero.
Yeah. Well, sound off in the comments.
Well... like I said, have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and keep holding people accountable. Hold yourself accountable. Hold others accountable. It's our new watchword for the end of this year and for 2021. We're going to be holding
2021
them.
2021 will. Yeah,
Chapo Trap House.
Year of accountability.
Chapo Trap House. Hold them accountable.
Year of accountability, baby. Everyone's going to be so fucking accountable. They won't be able to handle it.
It's the most important thing you can do.
Yep.
All right. Till next time, guys. Bye bye.
Till next time.